Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Encore.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who afford us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and sweet home Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. That means they do it without charge, they do it without price, and they do it without fee. We have so little money, we had to negotiate free and get it for half of free. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us from print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does the fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the family is the basic unit of our society. As the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, and basically so does the world. Most of the problems we're having today with drugs and alcohol are coming from children who have grown up without being taught proper basic principles. Now, you teach children correct principles, they can teach themselves. But without that fundamental foundation of morality and right and wrong, they just kind of grow themselves up in the gangs, in the clubs. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll is the kind of environment. And then, of course, we have the video game, the violence of the video games today. It's not a new phenomenon anymore, but these children grow up with these bloody video games, and of course we encourage the children to get on the computer, the wizardry of modern technology, and so they can learn this thing and be that much ahead of the learning curve and learn how to work these mechanisms and these machines of vast knowledge and wisdom and understanding, and they can manipulate these games, and they're babysitters. Hey, go sit on the computer and surf the world, and they play games, and they talk to each other, and inappropriate language, and bodies that disappear, blood, guts, and mayhem, and then we wonder, what's wrong with our children? And then they end up in prisons, and alcoholics, and drug addicts. Oh, boy, it looks pretty dismal. Well, Harold, tell me how dismal the family looks today.
Well, it's been a tough week. I had one family, the son is still living at home, although he's 28. 3 years ago, he decided that he would self-diagnose ADHD in himself. So he went to a psychiatrist, and of course, you can find doctors who will write you a prescription for amphetamines to treat that. If a person's taking a medication that they need, their condition will eat up the medication. But if you're taking a medication you don't really need, then it does strange things to the brain. Well, Wednesday night, after I met with the parents, they got home and their son, there were three sheriff's cars in front of the house, and he had been arrested for running down the street naked. Amphetamines mimic, amphetamine dependency mimics other mental conditions, even schizophrenia and paranoia, and it's just a mess. People diagnosing themselves, taking medications they don't need, and then having, it's either the amphetamines exacerbate a mental condition, or it could be a mental condition, a true mental condition, or it could just be the drug side effects mimicking a mental condition. It takes a while to figure out which it is. Fortunately, the solution is the same. Get clean and sober. And so he's been held in a mental hospital and had a doctor's care and was able to detox, which is what he really needed. But it's just a mess. Indeed, kids need sound, solid principles. And in my opinion, one of the main principles are the spiritual principles, a relationship with God, our Creator. So it's a process of getting our priorities straight again. And I think that's really our biggest need here in America, is to get our priorities straight and take care of the kids and have sufficient gratitude for all the blessings God's given us. So, and that's just one case out of several that have been in crisis this week. It's been a tough week. But I am grateful to be in recovery. I wanted to tell our listeners that the radio program and the website, rumradio.org and Rum Radio, these have been a labor of love for Joseph and me. Joseph's been footing the bill for over 4 years. It's not a money-making proposition. It's a money pit. He's spent thousands of dollars keeping it going. There's a lot of great, great information there on the website. And the idea is to go back to the basics and help people really discover what recovery, the foundations of recovery, and that is working the steps with someone else. So at first you find a sponsor and learn to work the steps. Then later you become a sponsor and help the new guy to work his steps. So let's see. Oh, we have a call-in number, 949-534-0621. 949-534-0621. Please call in and make some comments, be part of the program. So let me turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. I like to think of an attitude of gratitude as a prayer unto God.
Yes.
A large amount of the program of recovery, both AA, NA, and CA, by the way, we're none of those three. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. We're not affiliated with any of the fellowships, although I like using the big book, and I'll use the NA text as well. They have some good stuff in NA, and why not? The big book, matter of fact, the big book says on page 164, we know so little. This book is only meant to be suggestive. More shall be disclosed to both you and to us if your own house is in order. They're talking about your spiritual house. As you grow spiritually, you'll grow in understanding and effectiveness. We don't hold to anything in specific that as long as it helps the next sufferer, we're in. Good enough. You know, we don't have a monopoly. Nobody has a monopoly on this thing. What we do is that we do the best we can, and I think information and knowledge is critical. At least it helps. We found that I had an argument. There's a little bit of an argument on one of the Facebook deals. I put barriers to recovery about relapse, and there was like there's 13 things to look at. I have it on the website. Exhaustion and omnipotence and being hungry, angry, lonely, tired, but it drags some of the things out that if continued on in this area can cause relapse into drug and alcohol use. And one of the fellows turned around and says, no, that's not good. He says, we have no mental defense against the first drink. And that's, to me, that's convoluted thinking. You know, I understand that's in the big book, but knowledge is power. You know, if you are aware of these situations, then you have more of an ability to address them as you can discern they're going on. You understand that? How does that make sense to you, Harold?
Absolutely, yeah. The fact that hungry, angry, lonely, tired are not in the big book does not make them valuable tools. Information is power. Knowledge is power. And we've got to use everything we can to improve our recovery and to improve our relapse prevention plan. Dr. Terry Gorski is one of the greatest workers in the country on relapse prevention. He's helped millions of people with their relapse prevention plans. He has a 37-step process to form a relapse prevention plan. Very, very thorough, as you might guess. And it's built on and expands on the idea that we've got to watch out for being hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. It's just these are ideas, principles from the big book that are condensed and very, very effective in helping me not relapse. That's the whole idea. Stopping drinking for me was relatively easy. Staying stopped, that's a completely different story. And we need all the tools we can get. So go ahead, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. There was a little, before we get into, I'm going to have you read How It Works from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Big Book is the template of all 12-step recovery programs. All of the other 12 steps come from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's originated there. It's not in the Bible. It's not anywhere else. It all started with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe it was a gift from God. I tell people, if it's not a gift from God, why have you adopted it? And if it is a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change it? It works just fine. And Harold is going to explain how rarely that it fails if you thoroughly follow this path. But before we get into that, something I wanted to address. It's one of the posts I have on the website. It's something, I won't get into the whole story, but I was at the, you know who Joel Osteen is, Harold? You know Joel Osteen, don't you?
The Smiling Minister.
Yeah, Pastor Osteen. I visit his church on Saturday night sometimes. There's a little enclave there, and I find it very interesting. It's not so much his prosperity and abundance preach, but they stick more to the Bible understanding. It's kind of, you know, I like to be around that. It's good for me to be immersed all the time in different ethics. And I'm sitting, they have little circles of little group discussions, and this fellow's sitting next to me, and I introduce myself, and he says, he doesn't know me at all. I never met him, so I introduced myself. He says, you know, I have a problem. And I said, okay, so pray tell, what's your problem? He says, I can't He says, I do a lot of speed, which is methamphetamine. I says, how much do you do? He says, how long have you been doing it? He says, 30 years. I says, you addicted? No. He says, when he tries to get off the drug, he goes into physical withdrawal. But he's insisting he's not addicted. There was a long conversation because I do the addiction recovery. I gave him a card. And he was telling me about a dream he had and all this, and all led to the fact that he's spiritually being prompted to get off the drug. But he couldn't hear what I was saying. He couldn't understand the fact that he could not get off that drug. So when I saw him the week later, he had sores on his face. And I had told him that his body is starting to disintegrate.
Yes.
His body starts to putrefy, you know, because with the speed, you know, they scratch, they get an itch, they scratch their face, they get sores. I mean, it's like he's looking rough, but he can't mentally, he doesn't have a defense against that drug anymore. It's beyond him. He can't conceive of stopping that drug. And that's the way it is with addiction. A lot of folks don't understand that because they don't have addictive personalities. They haven't fell into the grips of the disease. But that's where he was at. It's a good little post. If you get an opportunity to read that, it's a highly spiritually evolved understanding. It's a short little thing, but it gives you an idea what denial looks like. You know, the denial just ain't a river in Egypt, folks. And this guy was sort of like the extreme example of self-will run riot. So, Harold, if you would, I'd like you to read How It Works from page 58 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll get into tonight's story. It's Fallen Women Rise Up and Become Angels with Dirty Faces. We're going to discuss about some of the pioneer women of AA and the recovery community. So if you would, Harold?
All right, very good. I've got it right here. This is Chapter 5 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry His message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventure before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would,
God could and would if He was sought.
Yeah.
Thank you, Harold. People usually chime in the meetings. You're welcome. This is usually said in most meetings. I'd like to also let you know that we believe that drugs and alcohol are equal opportunity destroyers. Although 5 times as many people die from alcohol than all the other drugs combined. Wow. A lot of people don't get that. They would think it was one of the other drugs. No, it's alcohol is the drug of the easiest drug to obtain. It's on every street corner somewhere, and it's legal, so there it is. If you can't get anything else, alcohol is available, and alcohol is a killer. Car accidents, people in prisons, you name it. It's one of the big demons, and if you don't think it's a demon, that's why we call it demon rum. Spirits of alcohol, there's something Carl Jung, whatever, how do you ever pronounce it?
Jung.
Psychiatrist.
Jung.
Jung?
Jung.
Jung. Jung. Jung. Jung.
That's it.
Hey, Jung. Hey, what's wrong Jung. With you? He's a Jung. he was a prominent psychiatrist in the around what 19 in the 20s and 30s, or along with Freud. They were the top 2 men of the field, and little different philosophies. But Jung was part of the group that influenced Bill W., one of the co-founders of AA, and he wrote a piece. We have it on the website. It's Spiritus Contra Spiritum, Spirit in the Ravages of Spirits. So there's something to it. It was man's search for a wholeness with God. In medieval language, the alcohol was a lower form of spirituality, which is an interesting concept. It makes a lot of sense on that kind of level. Okay. Well,
the religion,
nice, Joe. You had something, Harold?
The pagan religions in ancient times, biblical times, were based on drunken orgies, and they believed that getting drunk made you closer to their gods.
Interesting. You know, the Had you been to the Fine Art Museum here in Houston?
No.
It's really interesting. I take my granddaughter Claire there quite often. It's one of my favorite places. It's not hers, but she goes along. I say, Claire, this outing is about Papa. Will you go along with me, honey? She'll go, and then she goes along as best as she can. One of the reliefs they have in the hallway, and before you go upstairs to the fine art, is an ancient relief. And on this relief, it shows the triumphant return of Diogenes? I think it's Diogenes from India, introducing alcohol to India.
Wow.
Dionysus. Yeah, Dionysus.
Yeah.
And all the demigods are with him. He's the nymphs, the satyrs, Pan, Bacchus is there with the grapes. And the interesting part about this relief, he's being held up by two centurions, two Roman centurions with shields on their back. So the government is buoying this guy up and protecting him as he's going about his merry way, introducing alcohol and licentiousness to the world. Got a ring to it?
Yeah. Interesting.
If you ever get to see it, it's really quite fascinating. Most people look at that. They wouldn't get that in 100 years. They don't get it. They see it for just a physical thing and just pass by. But if you take a closer look at what's going on, it's really quite a spiritual piece.
That's interesting.
It is. Yeah, very much. I point to that like that to Claire. All right, so this we're going to have a show that a lot of our shows in the past where we've reduced the rumradio.org website to audio. So as we took posts and pages from the website and reduced it to radio show. So this way, in case you had a problem reading or the blind or what have you, you could download that part of the website. And this way it would be available to you in an MP3 format. You could download it, record it, and play it at your leisure. So you'd have the ability to have most of the site in audio. So we're going to do one of the posts. This is a recent post. It's called Fallen Women Rise Up and Become Angels with Dirty Faces. Marty Mann and the Early Women of AA. A tremendous change has taken place over the past few generations in the way alcoholics are viewed in our society. Although it is undeniable that some level of unawareness and misunderstanding remains, substantial improvements have been effected since the 1930s. We have cause to be grateful. The once virtually universal stigma that besieged alcoholic men were exponentially greater for women. Nice women didn't drink to excess. This made it extremely difficult to admit to a drinking problem in the first place. As our pioneers battled not only for their own sobriety, but for some level of respectability, their reluctance to associate themselves with beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, sick, plain crackpots, and fallen women. In 12 and 12, page 140, can be looked up on the some degree of sympathy. So do you know what they mean by fallen women, Harold?
Ladies of the night?
Fallen women, well, they've been compromised. They believe back then, you've got to remember, this was a very strong Christian-based country at the time. Fallen women were women who were alcoholic and had compromised their virtue. And once they had gone to that point, once they were compromised, it was just part and parcel of the alcohol, which is true even today. Alcohol takes away inhibitions. So since a woman would be an alcoholic, it was assumed that she was also had very loose morals. She was fallen. She was a fallen flower. And once that happened to a woman, there was no redemption. A fallen woman could not rise up again. She was beyond redemption. Of course, many men failed to get sober but were able to come and go without fanfare. The woman drunk seemed more disruptive. Explosions took place over, out of bounds, romance, and the arrival of alcoholic women at the early gatherings. According to Bill Wilson, whole groups got into uproars and numbers of people got drunk. We trembled for AA's reputation and for its survival. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Boys, page 241. It did not help that AA's earliest efforts to rehabilitate women did not go well. When Caroline, ex-wife of Hank Parkhurst, called her sister Dorothy, the wife of a Cleveland AA member, Clarence Snyder, to tell her that she was bringing a woman to Akron from Chicago for the cure, Dorothy was nervous about telling Dr. Bob. From Dr. Bob and the good old timers, we know that her trepidation was warranted. Dr. Bob threw up his hands and said, "We have never had a woman and will not work on a woman." But that, by that time, Carolyn was on her way with Sylvia K., page 180. Sylvia K. Arrived late in the late summer of 1939, and the men of AA were immediately tripping over themselves in the effort to talk to her. By all accounts, the drunken divorcee and heiress from Chicago was stunningly beautiful. And in an era where America was still feeling the effects of the Great Depression, Sylvia was getting alimony of $700 per month. A comparison to Dr. William Silkworth's rather paltry salary of $40 a week. As a psychiatrist at Towns Hospital puts proportion to the enormity of this stipend. All too soon after her arrival in Akron, Sylvia began tripping over herself. Clearly, the little white pills that she was taking were not saccharin, as she was claiming a nurse was flown down from Chicago to take care of her. After talking to Dr. Bob, Sylvia decided to live in Akron. This caused great consternation since her presence threatened to disrupt the whole group. But someone told her it would mean a great deal more if she could go back and help in Chicago. This appealed to Sylvia, so the members put her and her nurse on the train. Sylvia headed for the dining car and got drunk. Dr.
Wow.
Bob and the Good Old Timers, page 181. This tale has a happy ending, as she sobered up when she got back to Chicago and contacted Earl T. They both worked diligently to grow AA in Chicago, and to this very day remained revered and legendary figures in Illinois' AA. Sylvia's personal story, The Keys of the Kingdom, appears in the second, third, and fourth edition of our book. Sylvia K. was the first woman to achieve long-term sobriety in AA, although that distinction often erroneously conferred on Bill Wilson's close friend, Marty Mann. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Yes, I can imagine. Well, we've got to remember, put this in context. Here in America, women did not have the right to vote until 1930. So with the stock market crash of 1929, the Great Depression in the 30s, $700 was a huge amount of money. That is really an amazing story. And having this beautiful, rich woman show up, I can imagine they were very worried about AA back then. And it just goes to show that drinking is part of the problem, but if you're also taking pills, the way Bill Wilson was during his closest brushes with death, as he was in and out of sanitariums and hospitals, that's double trouble. That really is something. It's amazing any of them survived. That's interesting, Joseph.
The thing that really stands out to me, Harold, the most is the line that says, they both worked diligently to grow AA in Chicago, and that to this very day are revered and legendary figures in Illinois' AA. They both
Yes.
worked diligently. They made their lives a mission and not an intermission, and that made all the difference.
There you go. Yes.
Lil. Okay, we're going to get to another lady. Lil. Dr. Bob's concern about women in AA predates Sylvia's 1939 arrival. The first woman ever to seek help from the folks who were not yet but would one day be AA is identified in Dr. Bob and the good old timers only as Lil. There was a man we called Victor, a former mayor of Akron, and a lady we'll call Lil, who was the first woman to seek help. Together, Victor and the later known as Lil started out to write the 13th step long before the first 12 were even thought of. What is more, they say it began in Dr. Bob's office on his examination table while he was at the City Club engaged in this sacrosanct Monday night bridge game. In any case, Victor decided it was time for him to go home, but Lil was loaded. Page 97. Lil wouldn't leave, so Victor called Ernie G, AA's number 4, for assistance. Lil grabbed some pills from Dr. Bob's medicine chest and was trying to gobble them while the two men chased her around the examination table in what must have appeared like a scene from Benny Hill or the Keystone Cops. Ernie recalled that she made a dive for the window. I caught her halfway out. She was strong as a horse and used some profanity I had never heard before or since. I got her quieted, and Doc came. We took her out to Ardmore Avenue, the Smith home, and put her in a room in the basement. He stayed there 2 or 3 days, and then her people took her home. Of course, they were never too kind about it, though we did handle it her right. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, page 98. This tale also has a happy ending as well, as a message of open-mindedness, according to Sue Widows, Dr. Bob's daughter. Lil straightened out after a few years, but not through the AA program. Got married, had kids. AA isn't the answer for everyone. They say that Dr. Bob was leery of anything to do with women alcoholics for a very long time thereafter, although he still tried to help as best he could with anyone who came along, page 98.
Well, that's interesting. I can understand why he would really feel like he needed to be wary of women in AA. Just think of that. They're chasing her around the room. She's swallowing pills and trying to jump out the window at the same time. He caught her halfway
out. I'm in love already.
Say again.
I'm in love already. What are you kidding? My kind of girl. Was the window big enough for two?
There you go. Yes.
And this one, yeah, this gives you some background into the AA history and the women that evolved out of it. Florence R. Some consideration that was being given to the name 100 Men, as the title would become the big book. That's what it was going to be called at one time, 100 Men.
Yes.
Was squashed by the presence of Florence Rankin.
Oh, did we lose you? Did we lose Joseph? Oh, my goodness. Oh, there you are.
My jaw hit the phone. My jaw hit the phone and it jumped to another universe.
There you go. I'm glad you're back. Okay.
Okay. A female victory appeared in the 100 men. Florence Rankin, whose story, A Feminine Victory, appeared in the Big Book's first edition. At the time, Florence had been sober for little more than a year. Florence's hard-drinking ex-husband, who knew Bill Wilson from Wall Street, brought Lois to talk with her. That was March of 1937. She reports having great difficulty in seeing herself as an alcoholic. But after some slips, she got sober in early 1938. Again, this is another tale of AA's early women that does not end well. Florence moved to Washington, D.C., where she tried to assist Fitz Mayo, our Southern friend. That's the title of the story, in getting AA off the ground in and around the nation's capital. One of the prospects drew her romantic interest and got married. The bridegroom was unable to stay sober, and after a time, Florence got drunk as well and disappeared. When Fitz finally located her, it was in the morgue. She had committed suicide.
Wow. Yes, suicide is one area that medical science has made very little headway with suicide prevention in this country anyway. They've made a lot of other progress, medical science with early detection and early intervention has really made some incredible strides forward. 85% of the child leukemia cases have been prevented compared to the way things were a few years ago. 1,100,000 heart patients are saved each year that would have been lost a few years ago because now we have early detection and early intervention. But suicide is flatlining and no improvement with suicide prevention. It's really a huge problem, especially in the military. There's a retired general who's trying to make some strides forward, but he's receiving a lot of resistance for his efforts, as strange as that sounds. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. We have a post on the Room Radio about suicide. What if my sponsee is suicidal? It's the sincerest form of self-criticism, permanent solution to a temporary problem. It's also considered a slip, and if your sponsee is dead for more than 3 days, it's definitely a relapse. A little tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, although someone told me when they read that it was also considered a slip is when they decided not to kill themselves.
Yeah.
Because of the loyalty to the program, what happens is they become loyal to AA or NA, whatever their fellowship is. They talk in the meetings and they have a good rap, and life on life's terms gets too much. They fail to expand their spiritual program, or they're unable or unwilling to turn their minds to someone they can help. Life gets too hard. And so they can't drink or drug because they would be disloyal. So the only alternative is to kill themselves because it's too hard. Life is just too hard for them. They can't do it. And what I've discovered, which is really interesting, I've just been around for a while, that a suicide, when they make up their mind that they're going to kill themselves, usually a true suicide gives little or no warning what they're going to do. And the reason they don't do that is because they've decided to take an action, and this action will promise to relieve them of the pain. You ever been to a dentist, Harold, and you have a toothache, and you're sitting in the chair, and the dentist goes, "What tooth is that?" And for the life of you, you can't find it, because it stopped hurting.
Yes.
You ever had that experience?
Actually, a similar experience, yes.
Well, because you've taken an action, and that action actually has addressed to the pain, and this is what happens. They've made up their mind to take an action. That action is suicide. The pain is gone. The pain is abated, and they're almost looking forward. They're almost in a sense of exhalation, where they're excited about committing suicide. That's why they don't tell anybody, because they don't want to be stopped.
So
they've made a decision.
And as a lot of parents ask me, what are the signs to look for? And one of the signs to watch for is that a person has been blue and depressed for a long time, and then suddenly they feel a lot better. That's a danger sign for suicide.
Yeah, well, they think everything, no, because they've already made the decision. They've mapped
right.
it out. They've decided
yes.
how they're going to do it. They have their whole thing set up, and often there's not even a note because they don't want to be found out. Because they feel better now because they've made that decision to take an action to relieve the pain, which relieves the pain in itself. So they're looking
yes.
forward to doing it. This has been documented by suicide bombers and all kinds of folks. This is where I came up with this. The people on the planes during the World Trade Centers, you know, when they do that, they've interviewed some of them that have made it. You know, not them; they were all died, but other suicide bombers, and they get this feeling of exhalation that they're excited about. They're looking forward to it, and they will fight you if you try to stop them. So that's why they give no indication at all. Interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting.
Okay, let's get back on topic. Florence R. Some consideration that was being given to the name. Okay. Jane Studervant. Women who joined the Akron group in the earliest days had adequate, if not impressive, social credentials. Jane was married to the vice president of a large steel company, and Sylvia was an attractive heiress, Silkworth.net. Dr. Bob, February 1938 list of successes showed Jane S., 12 months. Jane was making the 35-mile trip from Cleveland to the meetings at T. Henry Williams' house from early 37, described as colorful, and vivacious. With a fine sense of humor, Jane was the first woman to have obtained any length of sobriety, meaning a few months. Dr. Bob in the Good Old Timers, page 122, that she has no story in the first edition is evidence that she relapsed. And by the time of Sylvia's arrival in September 1939, she remained only as a bad memory for Dr. Bob, prompting the previously cited, "We have never had a woman. We will not work with a woman," remark. Others came from the opposite end of the social strata. Their brief mention of an Indian waitress and early members, Warren C. recalled one woman who sought help but was thrown out of AA by the wives. She was so bad that they wouldn't allow her in their homes. Did you want to pick that up, Harold, at Dr. LeClaire Bissell?
You bet. I'd be glad to.
Sure.
These are such interesting stories. So this can be looked up on the internet at silkworth.net, www.silkworth.net. Yes, I should do that. Okay, let me pick it up here. The next story is Dr. LeClaire Bissell. Bissell was an MD, an addiction researcher with an inside knowledge of the malady, and the co-author of the 1987 book, Ethics for Addiction Professionals. Joining AA in 1953, at the age of 25, she stayed sober until her death in 2008. William L. White, who interviewed Dr. Bissell in 1997, described her as an unabashed atheist, a vocal lesbian, and a visible woman in addiction recovery before such openness was in vogue. Dr. Bissell's specific relevance to this essay is that she was personally acquainted with Mrs. Marty Mann and was able to relay to us Mann's own experience of AA in 1939. Marty shared with me that when she went to her first AA meeting at Bill and Lois's home in Brooklyn, the men were very afraid. The experience of some of the earlier women was that the men were very threatened by them and didn't want them in the group. That is what happened with Marty Mann. It was Lois Wilson who made her welcome and pretty much insisted the men behave themselves. White, William, Reflections of an Addiction Treatment Pioneer, an interview with LeClaire Bissell, M.D., 1928 to 2008, conducted January 22, 1997. So that is a, it's just really easy for me to picture how that would work. When these women showed up in a men's meeting, things were quite a bit different back then in our society. I'm glad things have changed. Over to you, Mr. Joseph.
Joseph. There you go. Well, the next one is Marty Mann. She's probably the most well-known of all these women. She was really a force for years in the recovery community, a major force. Born in 1905, Marty Mann grew up in Chicago, where her wealthy family provided her with every advantage, including the finest boarding schools and finishing school in Europe. In her big book story, Women Suffer Too, we're told, "My family had money. I had never known denial of any material desire. An attractive and popular debutante, Marty's circle was a young, privileged, and fast-moving crowd. It was the roaring 20s after all." Following her own debut in 1927 at the age of 21, Marty eloped with a handsome New Orleans party boy from a socially prominent family. Both bride and groom were considerably high on alcohol at the time. The young husband's dubious claim to fame was being his town's worst drunk. In her words, "My husband was an alcoholic, and since I had only contempt for those without my own amazing capacity, the outcome was inevitable. My divorce coincided with my father's bankruptcy, and I went to work in 1928, casting off all alliances and responsibilities to anyone other than myself. Women suffer too." Marty Mann image from Barefoot's World. Described by those who know her as a favored with beauty, brains, charisma, phenomenal energy, and a powerful will. She merged these with strong social connections to forge a successful career in public relations. "I had my own business, successful enough for me to indulge most of my desires. She even went abroad to live, that her life of success, hedonism, and fulfilled desires left her increasingly miserable. And reminiscent of Oscar Wilde's insightful dictum, there are only two tragedies in life. One is not getting what you want, and the other is getting it. The fun and frolic of the late 20s had become something altogether different 10 years later. Hangovers began to assume monstrous proportions, and the morning drink became an urgent necessity. Blanks became more frequent, with a creeping, insidious drink. had become more important than anything else. It no longer gave me pleasure. It merely dulled the pain. But I had to have it. I returned to America, and her drinking grew worse. The one-time debutante, the PR whiz kid, found herself on the charity ward of first Bellevue Hospital and then the Blythewood Sanitarium in Greenwich, Connecticut. Man psychiatrist Harry Thibault had been given a manuscript of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which he gave her to read. The first chapters were a revelation to me. I wasn't the only person in the world who felt and behaved like this. I wasn't mad or vicious. I was a sick person. I was suffering from an actual disease that had a name and a symptom, like diabetes or cancers or TB, and a disease was respectable, not a moral stigma. Women suffer too. That's where it comes from. Spreading the message expressed in the previous quotation would eventually take Marty Mann far beyond the rooms of AA. You want to go on with meeting Bill Wilson? You want to do that, Harold?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Meeting Bill Wilson, in spite of not being happy with the number of capital G words present in the manuscript in April 11 of 1939, Marty was driven by Popsy M. to the Clinton Street meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The occasion must have been somewhat somber, as the government-imposed moratorium on foreclosures had been recently lifted, and the Wilsons were about to lose their home. At the gathering of the, quote, this group of freaks and bums who had done this thing, end quote, a surprising thing happened. Quote, I went trembling into a house in Brooklyn filled with strangers, and I found that I had come home at last to my own kind, end quote. In spite of this auspicious debut and a somewhat secular awakening about the need to let go of anger, Miss Mann did not go deaf to the siren call of fermented beverages. Several relapses preceded her achieving a long-term sobriety well into 1940, possibly just one more illustration of the insidious nature of the malady. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Yeah, these are some of the, this gives you a little bit more idea of what alcoholism looks like. A lot of people don't get to see this. The Yale Plan for Alcohol Studies, when Dr. E.M. Gelink, America's premier researcher into alcoholism, joined Dr. Howard Haggard, medicine, and Dr. Sheldon D. Bacon, sociology, to form the Yale Plan for Alcohol Studies. They had a problem. In order that they not be viewed as ivory tower types with only a superficial academic knowledge of real alcoholism, they needed a real alcoholic, Exhibit A. Of course, this issue was not unrelated to fundraising. Marty Mann joined these men in the noble cause of bringing change to public attitudes toward the disease and its sufferers. She felt the calling to work in the field of alcoholic education, and in particular, she desired to help women alcoholics who were cursed with a double stigma. The National Committee for Education on Alcoholism, Incorporated, the organization Marty funded, opened its offices October 2, 1944, NCEA, eventually to become the National Council on Alcoholism, received an enthusiastic endorsement from the grapevine. It's also only 4 months old. It also received the support of many prominent and some not so prominent people whose names included those of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith appeared on the committee letterhead. The AA co-founders' names on the letterhead gave the impression that the two groups were connected. To confuse matters further, Marty, as she spoke across the country on behalf of her new organization, was breaking her own anonymity. Passing On, page 320. Ultimately, Wilson and Smith withdrew from NCEA and became just persuaded that total non-affiliation was the only answer, as they had inadvertently associated AA with a plea for public funds by Mann's organization, a solicitation that went out at some point to AA members. Additionally, Marty agreed to discontinue public identification herself, as only AA members tend to refer themselves as alcoholics. After becoming sober, though, the fellowship, or those who had gotten sober by any other means, typically referred to themselves as ex-alcoholics. Published in 1950 is the primer on alcoholism, and republished in 1958 is the new primer. Mann explained both the AA program and the goals of the National Council on Alcoholism is this widely read book. Anonymity issues aside, the NCEA with Mrs. Mann, a spokesperson, Exhibit A, was quite successful in communicating the three tenets of its core message. Alcoholism is a disease, and the alcoholic is a sick person. The alcoholic can be helped and is worth helping. Alcoholism is a public health problem and therefore a public responsibility. These ideas are so universally accepted today that it can be difficult to imagine that they were both revolutionary and counterintuitive at the time. In the 1950s, famous journalist and newscaster, he was huge, young people. Edward R. Murrow included Marty Mann on his list of the 10 greatest living Americans. Murrow is brilliant, portrayed by Canadian David Strahan in the 2000 film Good Night and Good Luck, directed by George Clooney and nominated for several Academy Awards. Mann's breach of her own anonymity for the sake and good of others clearly had mostly positive outcomes, and it's hard to know the causes leading to her relapse at 20 years sober.
Wow.
Harold, 20 years at a relapse, after all that,
I see it on
the public eye. What do we say what alcohol is? What? Cunning, baffling, powerful. Perhaps it is too much for us. But as one that has all power, that one is God, may you find him now. Now, I'm afraid she's an atheist. Perhaps this aggrandizement of ego that is at the core of AA's fears for members who go public was a factor. AA also warns of the dangers of being a secret keeper. A man was an in-the-closet lesbian for decades. Her close friend knew the truth, but she shielded this additional stigma from the public to the point of retaining and using the title Mrs. her entire life. In spite of her returning to the use of her maiden name, her volatile love affair with the Countess may have also been a factor. All matters of speculation.
Wow.
People have also speculated that later in life she had been drinking at times when she was representing herself as sober. Boy, I've seen that before. Regardless, she's an iconic character in the history of AA and a far broader level in the worldwide treatment and understanding of alcoholism. Mrs. Marty Mann died in 1980, shortly after suffering a stroke. She was 75 years old. There were few things that have changed more since these early days than the position of women within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. From this less than auspicious debut and a mere token presence in 1939, women now comprise a full 35% of our society. Young women arriving new to AA in the 21st century may well be surprised and even displeased with the male-dominant language of the big book, but its reflection of a different era, fully three generations in the past, much is owed to these intrepid female pioneers for blazing the trail for the women of today. And this piece was written by Bob Kennedy. hope I didn't break your anonymity, Bob, but we're not AA. So thank you so much for that. That was great. Harold, thoughts?
Well, it is a spiritual warfare. That's what I like to remember. That helps keeps me sober and clean. That any escape from reality that I engage in is extremely dangerous. And this week I've worked with several people who have they've quit drinking, but they've been sexually promiscuous, or maybe they've been relying on pills the way Bill Wilson did. So in this spiritual war, my first sponsor told me that drinking is a search for God at the wrong address. That really helped me a lot. And so when I say this is a spiritual warfare, that's one of the foundational principles in my recovery, that connecting with God, finding out how God thinks, has really been foundational in my recovery. And I owe a debt of gratitude to God and to all the godly men that I've worked with, and a few women along the way. This is a great article, and it really is interesting to see how much trouble women had in the beginning. Back to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Yeah, I believe this is a very informative piece. It was well done, taken from many different program literature pieces, and was really quite concise in and of itself. So it's all right there with the references to where to go, where this information come from. Dick B. does it that way, too. He doesn't write anything unless it could be verified and validated by agreed program literature. So this gives a good idea of the history. A lot of folks don't know. Some of the stuff was new to me. I had never really bothered going that deep. This is one of the benefits of having long-term recovery, is that you get interested in this information. When you first come in, you're not really interested much in anything other than getting out of the pain and hopefully getting sober and then trying to maintain that as long as you can. But this really helps. Knowing the history, knowing the past, will give you a platform to stand on. We're standing on the shoulders of giants. They really didn't know how this thing worked. This was a God deal. This was inspired. And we have the ability to stand on the shoulder of giants today. So thank you, Harold. And like usual, if you're looking for good, solid sponsorship information, that's the key to recovery. The meetings are great. I love AA and NA meetings. They're funny. They're spiritual sometimes even. And opinion low. If you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. It's the fellowship. It's one side of our triangle. The other side of the triangle is service. And the service to our fellow creatures is about sponsorship and taking someone through the steps in a timely manner. One of the problems, I'll end with this, one of the misunderstandings we have is that attraction, not promotion. It's in the traditions, and it's fallen over into sponsorship. I don't know why that's happened. It just has. We're supposed to be attracted to our sponsor. That's a load. That's not in the big book. The big book gives us clear-cut, simple instruction three times. Go find a prospect and start working on them. If your prospect is not interested, go find another. Search out another who's desperate enough to want what you have. So we're going to search out. And then on page 19, it says the man making the approach. speaks of having the answer. That's the guy you want. Them. So we got a making approach. Go find another. And the one immunity is intensive. What's the first one? Harold, be with me. Yeah, fill me in. What was the first one?
I'm having a brain freeze also.
It's a dual brain freeze.
There you go.
Go find a prospect and start working on them. Go find another and the man make an approach. Go find another and make an approach. So we're expecting the new guy to walk in, the new woman to walk in, and eventually she sits in enough and he sits in enough meetings to finally get the gist of the thing. We're wasting precious time. We're wasting precious pain. Pain is the motivating factor. We're wasting that. We're squandering the pain while they're sitting in the meetings trying to figure this stuff out. They don't have to figure it out. Someone was there before them that have already figured it out. Now you take them by the hand and you help them figure it out. They don't have to figure it out on their own sitting in the meeting. Well, that's enough out of me. So remember, go find your prospect and start working on them. Make step five. Step five in the 12 and 12 says, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So it's not in the big book. It's in the 12 and 12. Some of the big book thumpers, that's people who just, if it's not in the big book, it doesn't exist, which really goes against the big book because it says we know so little. It's a suggestive or see where religious people, you know, it's open. It's the big book says, look, there's other things that we can do. Well, let's get more information. The 12 and 12 are 10 years of practical experience from using the big book. Yay. So it says now this sponsor, who hears the fifth step? Harold, who hears the fifth step?
A sponsor hears a fifth step.
A sponsor. So until you've heard a fifth step, not only were we supposed to speak a fifth step, we're supposed to hear a fifth step. Until you've heard a fifth step, you still don't belong. Step five is the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So until you hear a fifth step, you're circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it's another crash and burn. So I'd like to see, if I was king, and of course that's not going to happen, that step five, hearing a fifth step, becomes a rite of passage. You don't share a meeting until you've heard a fifth step. You don't become a GSR until you've worked a fifth step. You don't become a DCM until you've worked a fifth step. These are the people in positions of leadership. You don't do anything until you've heard a fifth step because you don't belong. Why would you have someone who doesn't belong do these things? Harold, why?
Well, I agree totally. We need to – I explain to people that are new that one of the reasons that we want you to learn to go through the 12 steps with pen and paper and a sponsor is so that you can help the people newer than you go through their 12 steps. That's what I commonly include in the introduction to somebody new to the 12-step meetings. Joseph.
If we did that, you see, not enough people will come into the room that everybody's going to be able to sponsor. So you're going to have a drought of prospects. You know what you'd have to do? You're going to have to go find another. You're going to have to find a prospect. Where would you find a prospect? Well, find the prospect at the three-quarter house.
Yeah,
the treatment centers, halfway houses, the rehabs have already grabbed them. I've talked to some of those folks. They're more than happy to have AA come in there and to help them make the transition from rehab to long-term recovery in AA. They're more than happy to do that. You got the missions, the halfway, three-quarter houses, the VA, they're there. There's 104, according to Google, there's 140 million alcoholics in the world. There's 2,100,000 in the rooms. We got plenty of chairs. There's plenty of chairs, folks. You know, we can make it standing room only, but you know what the problem is, Harold?
What?
Taking an action. Bill W. said pain was the touchstone of all spiritual growth, and you can't grow spiritually and be comfortable at the same time. Folks just don't want to get out of their comfort zone, and it's so comfy in those meetings. It's just very comfortable. So you're telling me to leave that meeting, get on my horse, and go get somebody. Yeah? You got to be kidding me. What have you been drinking?
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, I think we'll close her up. Thanks again, Harold.
Yes, you're welcome.
Like I said earlier, if you're looking for solid sponsorship information, this is all Big Book 12 and 12. Agreed to program literature, things that have worked. The Big Book says 50% got well right away. Another 25% after a few relapses. Wow, 75% recovery rate. Sign me up. We can do that again. It can be done again, but action has to be taken. The magic words in AA is action and more action. But faith without works is dead. So remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night, kiddo.
Good night.